Welcome back to Midpoint, friends. It is August 13th, 2025. We are your Mid-Florida, Mid-Week, Mid-Morning source for news and public affairs on WMNF Community Radio at 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Shelley Reback. Today we have a terrific guest, former Assistant U.S. Attorney and Federal Prosecutor Michael Gordon. The Attorney General, Pam Bondi, fired him last month without cause following his outstanding performance review and his latest successes in court, including prosecuting a multi-million dollar fraud defendant, Leo Govoni, who allegedly stole around $100 million from a fund for special needs children. We are going to find out about the truth of why Mike Gordon was fired and what he plans to do about it. But first, as we do, let's take a look at some Florida news nuggets that you may have missed from the last week. Yesterday, Ron DeSantis appointed Florida State Senator from Hillsborough County, Jay Collins, to be our new lieutenant governor. We all know that's really a do-nothing job in itself. Its real value is that it is often a job for a governor in waiting. Former Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez got her big-dollar payoff being appointed by DeSantis as a state university president. Now, speculation has already started about who will replace Jay Collins in Florida Senate District 14, the Hillsborough County-based district that Collins currently serves after he beat Janet Cruz for that seat in 2022. Janelle Irwin reports for Florida Politics that Collins' departure from the seat will set up a special election to fill it for the remainder of his term through 2026, and that will no doubt give Democrats hope for reclaiming it, especially in a year where the party is already hoping to capitalize on 2026 midterms that are expected to serve as a referendum on Donald Trump's second presidency. But a flip in District 14 is still a hard uphill climb for Democrats. But hope springs eternal for them. Senate District 14 does underperform the Republicans' recent statewide domination by about half the margin. That district is more left-leaning than the state as a whole. But the Republicans will have a big money advantage in a special election, and that could rule the day. All right, next, here's the news that former Orlando area Republican State House Representative Carolina Amesty is off the hook from federal fraud charges and free as a bird. She was charged with lying to obtain $122,000 in COVID-19 relief funds through a foundation bearing her name and a car dealership that federal investigators don't think was even licensed to operate. This wasn't even the first time that Amesty was charged with fraud. Last year, she was accused of improperly notarizing a licensing form for the small Orlando area college, I put air quotes around college, that was run by her family. Those allegations, first published in an investigation by the Orlando Sentinel, led to a probe by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and a state grand jury indictment in Orange County Court last summer. But after Amesty lost her bid for re-election to the state house, outgoing Orange County State Attorney Andrew Bain, who was appointed by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis after DeSantis removed the duly elected state attorney, Monique Worrell, from office, well, Bain signed off on a settlement agreement with Amesty that called for his office to drop the charges. And the deal required only that Amesty set aside and log some 30 hours of community service, and the case would be dismissed against her. The federal fraud charges were made public just before President Joe Biden left office, and soon after, President Trump appointed Pam Bondi as Attorney General. And soon after that, Amesty retained Brad Bondi, Pam's brother, as her defense attorney. And soon after that, all the federal charges against Amesty were dismissed. Prosecutors in the Middle District of Florida, which is where we are, now headed by a U.S. attorney appointed by Trump and Pam Bondi, said last week that they were no longer pursuing their case against Amnesty. Nope. No longer interested in prosecuting that fraud. But the Orlando Sentinel reports that people are questioning whether Amnesty seemingly leveraged her status as a politically connected, up-and-coming Republican to help her game the justice system, one that is increasingly willing to look the other way when members of the party in power are accused of breaking the law. Of course, Pam Bondi's brother, Brad Bondi, Amnesty's lawyer, claims that he provided 500 pages of documents that show Amnesty's innocence. Did he? We'll never know, since those prosecutorial files are sealed. But Amnesty's fate looks pretty sweet when compared to other pandemic fraud cases that the Middle District of Florida has prosecuted. A little over a week ago, the office issued a press release about a 59-year-old postal worker from Ocala who pleaded guilty to obtaining roughly only $20,000 in COVID-19 relief funds by falsely claiming to own a landscaping business and submitting fraudulent tax documents. He faces up to 20 years in prison. Now, Amnesty claims her exoneration is due strictly to the talents of her legal defense team headed by Brad Bondi. As a former criminal defense lawyer, I'd like to give Brad Bondi the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he's a great lawyer, but it sure smacks of preferential treatment, doesn't it? All right, we are now in a situation where we have to ask if this Justice Department is dropping cases against its friends. The recent experience of my guest, former federal prosecutor Michael Gordon, seems to bear that out. So let me introduce him. Mike Gordon was a federal prosecutor in Tampa from January 2017 until about 6 weeks ago, when he was fired by the Trump administration because he prosecuted people who rioted at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, he says. Mike grew up in San Antonio, Texas, and he went to college at Yale. He spent his 20s teaching 11th and 12th grade English, history, government, and other subjects at a school just outside Washington, D.C. He then moved to New York City and changed careers, attending NYU Law School. After graduation, Mike stayed in New York. He worked as a clerk for two different federal judges and then became a state prosecutor for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, where he focused on domestic violence. In 2017, Mike Gordon moved to Tampa and joined the U.S. Attorney's Office. During his 8.5-year career there, he prosecuted violent gangs, armed robbery crews, drug trafficking organizations, and business fraudsters, embezzlers, tax cheats, cyber criminals, and January 6th rioters. He was rated outstanding, the highest possible rating, every year. And he's here with us today. So welcome, Mike. Can I call you Mike?
You can. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Mike, tell us, how were you fired? What were the circumstances? And why are you so convinced it's because you prosecuted January 6th rioters? I mean, and why is this a big deal? Can't anybody be fired from their job?
Yeah, I'd actually, let me start with that, because okay, that's the question that I get most often when people talk to me or they hear about what happened and they don't understand sort of why this is so outrageous. It is the case that most people can be fired for any reason in their job, but not true for most federal workers, right? Not people who are politically appointed change out in every administration. That's normal. They can be fired for any reason. But that's just the very top people at each agency. Career civil servants, like prosecutors, but also the people who administer your Social Security benefits, or the people who work in the post office, or federal law enforcement agents. Literally millions of workers are covered by a law, the civil service protection laws. And those laws actually make it illegal to fire those millions of federal workers for anything other than cause.
But isn't Trump doing that now?
Yes.
Or Doge doing that now in his name?
Right, they are. And that's what's been so outrageous about all the firings, that are most of the firings that have been happening over the past few months, is they've been in complete and total disregard for the law. The government that's supposed to be upholding the law, administering the law as it is instead just patently ignoring it when it's not convenient for them. And that's why, you know, is why I know we're going to talk about later, that's why I'm actually suing the Trump administration, because the Department of Justice, supposed to be upholding the law, has just blatantly violated it in firing me and others.
All right. So now you're convinced that you were fired, though, for a particular reason.
Yes.
Because you prosecuted these January 6 rioters. Tell us about why that's your conclusion about your firing and how the firing came about.
Yeah. It's pretty easy to connect the dots because it's the only possible reason. So let me sort of paint the picture for you of what you were asking earlier about the circumstances of how I got fired. So, and to tell that story, I have to actually rewind about 5 weeks before I got fired. So I had been rated, I've been at the Department of Justice for 8.5 years, and I got evaluated every 6 months. And every 6 months for 8.5 years, I received an outstanding rating, the highest possible rating. 5 weeks before I was fired, I was handpicked to essentially join the Leo Gavone investigation, which a lot of people have heard of, but for those who haven't, Gavone was a businessman in Pinellas who ran an organization that administered trusts for people with special needs who had just terrible medical situations or things like that, and they put their money in trusts so they could use it to take care of their special needs while also still receiving government benefits.
Yeah, right? So these were people who had to have a trustee because they couldn't manage their financial affairs themselves, right, for the most part?
Not exactly. It has to do with actually a system that the government had set up. It's a law passed by Congress in order to make it so that people with special needs who received some sort of financial benefit. Let me give you an example. Imagine somebody, let's say a child, to make it, you know, sort of the most egregious victim of Gavone, a child who suffered a life-changing, debilitating injury from medical malpractice. They went
right.
in for
a
routine.
There's a recovery in a lawsuit.
Yes.
Now, Florida law provides that you can't give that just to the child. They can't manage their own financial affairs. You have to have a guardian or a trustee appointed to manage those affairs. And so Govoni's foundation or his company was essentially a trustee for those types of awards.
That's right. And the same thing could happen for adults.
Right.
You know, and the idea was that those people would be getting Medicare or Social Security, some other means-tested federal benefit. And now if you got a court settlement that gave you a lot of money, you might say, well, they don't qualify for Medicare anymore. And Congress said, that doesn't seem fair. We want to still let these people receive public benefits. And so they set up this trust system. The
right.
point is, Gavone administered these trusts, and he stole $100 million.
Allegedly. Yeah.
Right. I hear the former defense attorney in you.
There you go.
And, you know, is
that
the former prosecutor in me? Like, I know the facts.
Allegedly.
In that case.
Right. But I don't want to spend so much time on Gavone because I want to talk about your firing.
I'm getting to that because that's important. So the point is, that case had been investigated for 15 months, and it was sort of, it needed to get pushed over the finish line. And the U.S. attorney, Greg Kehoe, he handpicked me to join that team to get it over the line, which I did, right? So I joined that team, got up to speed, pushed the case over the finish line. We got the case indicted. That was Thursday, 6 days before I was fired. Monday of that next week, U.S. attorney's office had a press conference announcing the great success of that indictment. 2 days later, Wednesday, 2 days before I was fired, I had my most recent performance evaluation, again, rated outstanding. Asked my supervisor, hey, what are my areas for improvement? What are the things I need to be working on? He said, I can't think of anything. You're killing it. Right? The next day, really important argument in court was asking the judge to keep Gavone in jail during his trial, until his trial. That's a steep uphill climb. The guy's 67 years old. It's rarely done in white-collar cases. Two-hour argument. Judge sided with me, right? Kept Gavone in jail. Huge professional win. The next day, I was prepping a witness for trial in a different case that was supposed to go to trial 2 weeks later, when at 4:15 p.m., right after this week of huge professional success with a trial right on the horizon and another important case, administrative person in the office walks into my office, sort of busts in the middle of what I'm doing, this witness prep, which is an unheard of thing. It's beyond protocol. You don't do that. He walks in, hands me the letter, one-page letter. It says, you know, you're fired, no reason given.
Mm.
So I have to figure out, why was I being fired? Right. I asked the manager. He didn't know, but I reached out to friends, and I found out that that same day, two other January 6th prosecutors were also fired via identical letters. The only difference was the name at the top. And that told me all I needed to know, because it couldn't be my performance.
Right.
Nothing about what I had, the work I had done, the quality of it.
Now, these other two prosecutors, they're not in Tampa like you, right?
They're not. They're both in D.C.
Okay. So apparently, when all these January 6th cases arose, they were all going to have to be prosecuted in D.C. because that's where the crime occurred. And as I understand it, they put out a call for prosecutors to help take on some of these cases because the D.C. offices themselves didn't have enough trained prosecutors to prosecute these cases. Is that how you became involved?
It is. That's right. There were, you know, ultimately there were 1,500 cases charged for January 6th and many, many more that were investigated and not charged.
Mm.
So yeah, it was too big of a workload for the DC office to handle alone. So, and this is sort of routine in the Department of Justice when there's an overwhelming need, they sometimes ask for people to be brought in, and that's what happened here.
Okay, so you didn't have to move to D.C. You could, like, work in the Tampa office and then go up there for court appearances?
That's exactly right. Yep, I worked from home. This was still during COVID when it started, so I was working from home primarily and then flying to D.C. periodically for hearings, trials, meetings, et cetera.
Right, okay. So you were a volunteer, essentially, for the January 6th prosecutions.
I was. So what happened was the Department of Justice asked for people to volunteer to work on those cases. More people volunteered than they had space for. People raised their hands around the country.
Uh-huh.
And so the DC office had to make it a competitive application process.
Oh.
So I applied and I was selected.
Oh, okay. And why did you apply?
Because it seemed like an egregious attack on democracy itself. It seemed like the most important legal thing that had happened or criminal thing that had happened in my lifetime. I had watched it unfold live on television like everybody else.
Yeah, me too.
The combination of having been both a prosecutor and a history government teacher in my sort of prior career, I understood, you know, the significance of it, and I felt compelled to help. It was not only about the sort of stakes, but also, you know, I wanted to be sort of part of living and enforcing the values that I had both been teaching students as a teacher and then also standing up for in court.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. I mean, deep in my soul, I felt the same thing watching it. And, you know, of course, was not in any a position to, you know, do much to help. But there were so many people who felt the same way, who did things like scour the internet for videos and, divorcees turning in their ex-husbands that they spotted and all kinds of things like that. And of course, as we know, soon after Trump took office as president, he pardoned every one of those January 6th defendants, didn't he?
He did. And I have to say, it was stunning, shocking, gut-punching, heartbreaking when that happened. We all expected, when I say we, I mean the group of prosecutors who worked on these January 6th cases. We, based on Trump's campaign rhetoric, we all expected there to be some pardons. What we expected was that the misdemeanor defendants would be pardoned.
Misdemeanor are the lowest level of criminal defendants.
That's right. That's essentially the people who trespassed and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
We expected them to be pardoned. Never in a million years did we expect people who were caught on video assaulting police officers,
mm-hmm.
people who admitted in court, who pled guilty, to assaulting police officers and describe the facts of how they did so. People who were convicted by a jury of seditious conspiracy, right, of plotting to overthrow the government. Never in a million years did we think any of those people would be pardoned. And you know who else didn't think those people would be pardoned? Vice President J.D. Vance. Because he was asked that same question after the election already happened in the weeks before inauguration. And Vice President Vance said he didn't expect the president to pardon the violent criminals, because who would do that?
And isn't there one individual who was alleged to have been like egging on the rioters, who's now an official in the Justice Department?
Yeah, so that man's name is Jared Wise. So he was an ex-FBI agent who, you know, he was actually on trial at the moment the pardons came down. Not just on trial, his trial had finished.
And the jury was out.
The jury was out. The jury was deliberating at the moment the pardons happened. And so, you know, the judge had to go back and say, jurors, I'm sorry, I know you're deliberating, but...
Case
is over. But this man is...
He's an official in the Department of Justice, right?
He's on video egging on other rioters to kill police officers, having been an FBI agent himself. And now...
Now, he wasn't an agent at the time that occurred. No.
He's an ex-agent. But understand the significance of that. And he's not just any official in the Department of Justice, right? The role he has now is really important. So after Trump took office, he put a man named Ed Martin in charge of the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office as an interim person.
Right. He tried to make him the permanent new appointed U.S. attorney. And
that's right.
There's one of the rare occasions when Congress did not give him what he wanted.
Well, I'm only aware of two people that Trump has nominated for a position or chosen for a position that the backlash has been to the point that they did not receive it. One is Matt Gaetz for attorney general.
Right. And the other is Ed Martin. Right.
So Ed Martin couldn't make it past committee in Congress.
But he's still in the Department of Justice.
Well, that's what happened next, right? That's important. Is after that failure, the Trump administration installed Ed Martin in the Department of Justice in the office of the pardon attorney, and then allowed Ed Martin to create, or had Ed Martin create, something called the Weaponization Working Group.
Right.
And theoretically, the job of the Weaponization Working Group is to root out, you know, people who have weaponized DOJ against Americans. And that apparently means firing January 6th prosecutors.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. All right. Have you heard anything from your former boss, the U.S. attorney here locally, Greg Keough, or your former colleagues at the office since you were driven out? I mean, other than Keough, you don't have to mention any names because they could be in trouble, obviously, if you did, given what we've seen from your own experience. But what do your former colleagues say about your firing? What's the kind of thing that you hear? Are they concerned about cases that they might be involved in? Like, you know, for example, a case like Carolina Amnesty, for example, which has just been, trashed because she hired Brad Bondi, presumably. You know, are people concerned about the cases that they now take on and prosecute if they have any, connection to a defendant who themselves have connections to the Republican Party or the current administration?
Yes. So I hear, answer both those questions. So first, what I heard universally from everybody in my former office is how upset and outraged they were at my firing. Everyone recognizes it's unjust. And nobody from the firing came from D.C. No one in D.C. made so much as a phone call to anyone in management in Tampa to check in on.
So they claim they didn't know anything about it.
They didn't. Mm. I know they didn't. They were not consulted.
Mm.
In fact, when that administrative officer walked in and handed me the letter firing me, he also told me that he had been directed by D.C. not to tell management in Tampa that he was doing that.
Okay.
That he was tasked with doing that. They were blindsided in Tampa, and they're all outraged. In fact, people were so upset that just a few weeks ago when Attorney General Bondi came and visited the U.S. Attorney's Office in Tampa, which is a normal thing AGs do periodically.
Mm. Close to home for her.
That's right. People were asked to come do a photo op with her. And basically across the office, most people boycotted that. very few people
were. Oh, really?
Very few people were willing to come and take a photograph with her.
Interesting.
Because the morale was so damaged by my firing. Now, back to your other question about how people are feeling about their cases now. Everyone's worried. That's what I hear across the board is people tell me they all worry if they're next. Because if the precedent is allowed that a prosecutor can be fired for any reason, right, including just if the case they prosecute displeases the president for any reason, then we no longer have a political justice in this country. We no longer have prosecutors who are just following the facts and the law wherever they lead and charging crimes based on what people did, not what they think or who they voted for. We don't have that anymore.
Right.
What we have is prosecutors who have to evaluate the politics of it. And look, administrations change.
Right.
So just because your case pleases this president, is it going to please the next president?
Yeah.
Is every case you take, you know, is that something that might put your career on the line if you prosecute somebody that a later administration wanted protected? That is a terrifying situation for us to be in.
Yeah, I was going to bring this into our discussion later on in the show, but it seems appropriate now to ask you to consider that it seems nowadays that the prosecutorial philosophy in the Department of Justice is very different from how it's been throughout my lifetime and certainly through my career when I was in the justice system. In my experience as a federal defense lawyer, it used to be that there was a crime that occurred, and then the Department of Justice through the FBI or various law enforcement agencies would set out to investigate who done it, and how, before they made a public case for prosecution. But now it seems like the Department of Justice first picks a target and then looks for a crime that they can pin on that target, whether it's talking about Obama committing treason or Comey, who investigated Trump himself, or even that FBI agent, Peter Strzok, who was alleged to have made some disparaging comments about Trump in a private conversation. He must be guilty of something, right? I mean, it seems like it's all back-ass words now. What do you think about that?
Well, I have to draw a distinction there between the leadership of the Department of Justice currently, the political appointees, and the rank-and-file people like me, the line prosecutors who work across the country in the Department of Justice, including here in the Middle District of Florida and Tampa. Those are good people trying to do their job as they were hired. In other words, to follow the facts and the law without fear or favor. My former colleagues, I cannot speak highly enough of, including U.S. Attorney Greg Kehoe. I want to be clear on that. He is a model of a U.S. attorney. He's a former AUSA, a former federal prosecutor.
No,
himself.
I know. I was in cases with him on the defense side when he was a defense attorney, too.
But what's happening in Washington is different, right? There, I see exactly what you're describing, right? And in fact, and this is an important tradition. In Department of Justice, we do not comment publicly on active investigations. People understand that, but they go, oh, well, you're going to somehow mess up the investigation if you reveal something. That's part of it. But the other part of it is that you don't want to tarnish someone's reputation unfairly or unnecessarily. So if I were to announce, well, I'll give you an example. At the time I was fired from DOJ, I was investigating a prominent law enforcement person in Florida, right? Somebody who would, it would have made big news if we charged that person. We had not yet done so at the time that I was fired. I'm not going to ever say to anyone who that person was, because as right now, that person has not been charged with a crime. If I were to reveal, hey, the FBI and the Department of Justice was investigating this person, that tarnishes their reputation forever. And they are in law enforcement. We may never charge them. And if we never do, then they have no reason to be, that person should not be negatively thought of in society. But an investigation does that. So we don't comment that way because it's not fair. It's not just to do so. That tradition has been abandoned.
And that is, it's been abandoned except, It seems like that's one of the reasons that the Department of Justice could use for not releasing the Epstein files. I don't want to get into the whole Epstein thing, but still, you know, if there were names there of people who were not charged, you know, it could be damaging to reputations, for example, the full facts of what that person did or did not do, whether they just took a plane ride or whether they were a sexual predator of minors. We wouldn't know that just from...
No, that's
that,
fair.
Right?
That's fair.
Yeah. You know? But yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. And I wanted to ask you here, since you're talking about the difference between the political appointees in D.C. and the local prosecutorial management or leadership in the Middle District of Florida, when you were on those January 6th cases, you were in Tampa, but you were essentially working on the cases for D.C. Were you or your bosses on those cases given any guidance or directions about who and how to prosecute those particular January 6th individuals? Did, like, the president or Merrick Garland, who was the attorney general at the time that you were working on those January 6th prosecutions, did the president or Merrick Garland, who was the AG then, ever tell you what to do, who to do, how to do it?
Well, I want to distinguish between those two, because the president... No, because that was totally inappropriate under the tradition of the Department of Justice being independent from the White House. So, you know, those prosecutions, those investigations, prosecutions happened first under the end of the Trump administration and then throughout the Biden presidency. No, there was no direction from the White House. But from the Department of Justice leadership, from Merrick Garland down, you know, I would assume, yes, I only received direction from my supervisors. And my supervisors, you know, essentially the top level would be Greg Rosen, who was the chief of the Capitol Siege Section. That's what we called it. And then his boss was the U.S. Attorney for D.C. Hmm. The U.S. Attorney for D.C.'s boss would have been Merrick Garland. But because I only know what my boss instructed me, and I know from him sometimes what direction he received from
above
the U.S. Attorney in D.C.
It's a chain of command.
That's right. I can't comment on, because I just don't know what happened above that. I can't tell you, that person's name was, U.S. Attorney was Matthew Graves. So I don't know what direction Matthew Graves received from above him.
Well, you know, in any case, it doesn't have to be a case as significant as the January 6th rioters. But in every case, I know that there's discussion between and among line prosecutors, supervisors, and above about how a case should be prosecuted. Who, like within, like, let's say a corporate white crime case where there are multiple levels of org chart people who may or may not have been involved, there's always discussions about where the prosecution should stop. How involved were the people on the various levels of the org chart? And not only who should be charged, but how they should be charged. I mean, that's a normal thing, right?
It is. And let me give you an example from the January 6th prosecutions.
Thanks.
So
perfect.
When that event happened, there were many, many thousands of people that were among those rioters in one form or another. So how do you decide who you charge and who you don't? Those discussions were had early on by supervisors, you know, above my pay grade, but how do you make that distinction? And what they settled on as a general rule, there were some exceptions, but as a general rule, it was if you entered the Capitol, you were going to get charged with something. Mm-hmm. Even if it was just a misdemeanor, you know, the equivalent of a trespass, right? Mm-hmm. If you entered the Capitol building, even if all you did was step in for a second, take a selfie and step out, that was going to be the red line of that's too far, mm-hmm. right? Because to be clear, anyone who was on the Capitol grounds that day was trespassing, right? There were signs, there were fences, there was a restriction. But if you were on the grass outside and that's all you did, you could have been charged, but you weren't. That meant thousands of people with criminal liability were not charged by DOJ because of the exercise of prosecutorial discretion. And that came from the bosses deciding that was a line they were going to draw. If you stayed outside, but while outside you committed a felony, you destroyed property, you assaulted a police officer, etc., then you did get charged even if you didn't go inside. So that's one of those examples where that's totally normal. Supervisors, managers have these discussions, try to draw some sort of distinctions or rules that we can follow to be fair across the board. Because that's what justice should be. It should be fair, blind to things like who you voted for or what you think.
Yeah, and defendants should be treated equitably across the board, you know? I mean, that's one of the things that I always had to deal with as a defense attorney at sentencing time, you know, which was, look, this guy who did the same thing got a sentence of whatever, X, you know, probation, whereas you want to give my guy, you know, 3 years in federal prison. I mean, those kinds of questions of equity come up all the time. So it's interesting that that you explain how these decisions were made with respect to the January 6th rioters. I have a phone call here from David, who's been very patient. I'm going to bring him into the discussion. David, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Shelley. This is David, Mr. White Pepper Bryant.
Oh, hi, David. David, for those who don't know, is a programmer here at WMNF.
Yeah, I'm a news junkie, too. I find the whole Trump thing is fascinating but disturbing and not, it makes me angry. So, but I was just curious, like with Mr. Gordon, I don't understand why the national media didn't really pick up on the fact that, you know, he was working on the Giovanni case and, you know, the fact that I think it makes Bondi and the whole Justice Department look kind of bad to get rid of a prosecutor who is working with the most vulnerable people on the planet, you know, and their parents. And this guy kind of cheated them out of their money that they needed to take care of these most vulnerable people. But
well, let's be clear. Wait, David, just a second. But Mike, somebody's going to pick that case up, right? It's not going to just die because you were fired, right?
No, that's 100% correct. But I think what David's highlighting is the degree to which the leaders in D.C. didn't make so much as a phone call down to Tampa to say, hey, we want to get some retribution against this guy because of the January 6th prosecutions he did. But before we do that, let's check. Is he any good at his job? Is he working on anything important right now? Is that going to be disruptive or a problem? Is that going to backfire or, you know, reflect poorly on DOJ? They didn't so much as ask that question.
Okay, David, does that answer you?
Yeah, I would love to see some of the parents, you know, reaching out to New York Times, Washington Post, you know, like speak out against like how ridiculous or how outrageous this is. Cause it's just not right. And it's just, I know that, you know, the Trump strategy is to flood the zone and maybe it's getting ignored because of that, but it's a very important story and it's a bad look for Bondi and the whole DOJ. So I think the media needs to pick up on it. But.
Well, you know, I was telling Mike earlier, there's a great article in, I think it's 2 days ago, The Guardian. If you read The Guardian, there's a big article about Mike and his firing and the circumstance of it. And so I urge you to go check that out.
Right. And I'll give credit where it's due. Scott McFarlane of CBS News did write a piece talking about the impact of my firing on the Gavoni case, as did the Tampa Bay Times.
Yeah. All right, Dave, thanks.
I saw the McFarlane story. I just thought there just needs to be more. I think that it needs to go wider. So
all right. Well, thanks for calling in, Dave. Thanks. Appreciate it. I thought that Guardian article was really good. It was really comprehensive, and although it didn't focus on the Gavoni case, it really contextualized your firing and the circumstances of it. And going back to what we were talking about before, it does seem like the entire political philosophy or the entire prosecutorial philosophy of the Department of Justice has really changed now. And in that context, your abrupt firing without consultation, without any research, without taking opinions of your management, you know, in that context, it seems totally of a piece with the way that they're doing business now.
Well, it is, but it's even broader than that. And that's why, you know, I don't think that I'm particularly important, right, or that my firing is particularly important, but I think that what it stands for or the the consequences or the stakes of it are very large. And that is that it's just the latest example of the administration just ignoring the law. There is black and white law here. If you want to fire a civil service, a permanent civil service employee, you have to give them at least a month's notice. You have to you describe a merit-based cause for doing it. You have to give them an opportunity to contest that, first in writing and then orally if the hearing is required. Right, and then the actual firing has to have the merit-based reason.
But you're not unique in this regard. They're doing this to so many federal civil servants.
Point,
they're
right?
just plowing ahead with complete disregard for the law.
That's right. And so when we have a country where the government can just ignore the law when they want to, today it's the Civil Service Protection Law. What law will it be tomorrow?
Well, we know that because, for example, several whistleblowers have accused Emile Beauvais, who was just appointed to a lifetime appointment as a U.S. District Court judge, of when he was in the Department of Justice, telling prosecutors below him to just ignore the orders of the court, just ignore what the judges in that court were saying with respect to certain immigration cases. Just
That's
ignore
right.
the law.
So I taught government, and I think probably you and all your listeners took government at some point in high school, and you were all taught about the checks and balances and
right.
the genius of the framers.
It's fallen down.
Right. Well, the whole idea is that we have this system in which we cannot have a king or a dictatorship because of the checks and balances. But if the executive branch can ignore the law that Congress passed, we are in a very different country than the one we were all taught about.
If Congress doesn't protect its own authority, we're in a very different place. That's what I see happening, you know? We have a Republican-dominated Congress who is not protecting its own authority from the executive branch. That balance that we were taught about in high school government class, that no longer exists.
Right. And so, you know, if anybody who asked me that question about, can anybody just be fired and, hey, I can be fired in my job, what's the big deal? You know, to that I would say, okay, fine. If you think that should be the law, then lobby Congress to change it. But it's not the law as it is today. And we need our government to follow the law as it is, or we are on a slippery slope to the kinds of dictatorships that we call third world countries around the world.
Yeah, we're on the path to fascism if we're not there already. I mean,
that's terrifying.
It is terrifying. All right. I want to ask you about the fact that I personally have been informed by very reliable sources that the Middle District of Florida, which is the area from, like, I don't know, Fort Myers on a diagonal going east to Jacksonville through Orlando to Jacksonville, that the Middle District of Florida as a federal district had more January 6th defendants living here in this area than any other district in the country. That's what I've been told by people who I think would know. Is that true? And if so, why do you think we grow so many of them here?
Yeah, so I don't know if it's true. Those statistics are probably kept somewhere, but I haven't reviewed them to check that. Why do we grow so many here? That is a great question for a sociologist. I don't know the answer to. I can say there's a confluence of some factors, right? Certainly, you know, we are currently a Republican-leaning state that had voted for Trump in the last three elections. So there were probably a lot of supporters who lived here. We were a hotbed for the Proud Boys, which, you know, generated a
we
lot
have
of,
former General Michael Flynn with a warrior training camp in the Bradenton area. We have all of these Republican conservative influencers, say, and podcasters who've moved into Southwest Florida. I don't know. It's a little frightening that we grow so many of them here.
It is, but while I can't rank the states for you, I can tell you, though, it's not, January 6th was not really a red versus blue state issue in the sense that Pennsylvania and New Jersey, which have, you know, both states that have voted for the Democratic candidate in
governor races,
in recent presidential elections as well, enormous numbers of January 6th riders came from those states as well.
Interesting.
So, you know, it wasn't just sort of people from Florida by any stretch, but there certainly were a lot of Florida students.
I don't know whether that I'm comforted by that or appalled by that. But, okay, so one of the reasons that Trump is just yesterday, I guess, one of the reasons Trump is using for federalizing the District of Columbia is the backlog in criminal prosecutions in D.C. But isn't a big part of the reason for that backlog itself the administration's firing or reassigning of so many prosecutors and FBI agents since Trump took office? The FBI, headed by Trump acolyte Kash Patel, has reassigned the jobs of thousands of agents and eviscerated parts of the bureau that were tasked with investigating right-wing extremists. And, you know, D.C. has this unique situation where there's the Superior Court and the District Court, and one acts like essentially like a state prosecutor's office and the other acts like a federal prosecutor's office. But a lot of people have been transferred, reassigned, fired. And as a result, you know, it seems like there's a backlog in prosecutions there. Can you comment on that at all?
Yeah, sure. So first, the current U.S. attorney in D.C. is former Fox News host Jeanine Pirro. And she recently went on Fox and was talking about how much difficulty she's having enforcing the law in D.C. Because she's down 90 prosecutors.
Yeah.
Well, she's down 90 prosecutors in part because they fired 15 January 6th prosecutors on day one, have since fired more, and then have driven many, many other people out.
Well, let's talk about the fact that you're doing something about your firing. I want to get that in before we run out of time. What are you doing about your firing?
So I've sued the Trump administration for violating the Civil Service Protection Act law, along with two other co-plaintiffs. So that case has been filed in federal court in D.C., and the next step is the government gets a specific period of time, but they have to answer. And essentially, they're going to, you know, I can, as a lawyer, predict what I think is going to happen. They're either going to move to dismiss it and say it was premature, or they're going to answer it and say that the laws requiring them to give notice, they didn't have to follow them because they think those laws are unconstitutional. Mm. This question of whether the executive branch just has carte blanche to fire anybody that they want to, regardless of the law, that is going to get decided by the Supreme Court. One way, whether it's my case or a similar case, this
question
is
that is going to go to the Supreme Court, because they're going to say, my prediction, among other things, they're going to say that the president has the authority to appoint the attorney general, the U.S. attorneys in every district, and therefore that authority flows down to the littlest prosecutors. You know, they may say something like that as well.
They might, but just a brief history lesson here. All of these things were created post-Nixon. The civil service protections are a reaction first to 100 years ago when we had a spoil system that, created a kind of a nightmare scenario for the country where unqualified people were put in positions of power just because they were friends with the right person.
Oh, we have that now.
Well, but not like it used to be, right? Uh-huh. And then post-Nixon, throughout the 70s, laws were passed to create guardrails for the executive branch so we didn't have another Nixon. It's those guardrails, those 50-year-old laws put in place post-Nixon that this administration is trying to tear down and reverse.
Right. Do you think you'll have any trouble getting another job when you're ready to do so?
So yes and no. So the yes part is that, you know, I've never been a political actor. I have been somebody who follows the law wherever it leads without regard to politics. And now I've been sort of branded as this sort of, to some degree, you know, deep state operative, which is just untrue, but is being fired by the Trump administration. So it may be that some organizations, law firms, et cetera, might view me now as
dangerous.
As dangerous or as too much of a lightning rod.
Right.
On the flip side, I do not expect to have much trouble finding a job because I've been pursued by a number of firms and other legal organizations in town that I think recognize the career that I've built and the resume and the skills that I have. So
I'm so glad to hear that because, you know, we've heard so much about the capitulation of a lot of these big law firms that do business with the government or have clients that are looking for, you know, whether it's, you know, merger approval by the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice or other interactions with the federal government who've capitulated to the Trump administration's attacks on them. And, you know, we've seen both people in your position who have worked on cases that were against the Trump administration or against individuals in the Trump administration be let go, and some who have left voluntarily when their law firms capitulated because they wanted no part of that. It's an interesting legal landscape right now. So I'm glad to hear that you think that that won't be a problem for you. And I wish you a lot of luck with that.
Thank you very much.
But take the summer, you know, relax, enjoy your family, right?
Well, I have been. I've been focused on trying to be a good dad and a good, you know, good husband, a good dog father for the past, 6 weeks. Stayed up late last night making cookies for my daughter's first day of school.
All right. Well, before we let you go, is there anything else that you want our listeners to know about the circumstances that you're faced or about where you're going from here?
Just that.
Like, do you have like a website or something that talks about your case or a legal defense fund or what have you?
I don't. I don't have either of those things. There have been enough news reports that I haven't felt the need to publicize anything myself. And I'm not asking for money from anybody to help me with this. What I'll say is that, you know, I am deeply concerned about where the country is heading. And I am trying to stand up and speak up and fight for the same justice that I fought for when I was working for the government. I'm still fighting for justice. I'm still fighting for the people of the United States. But to do that, now I have to fight against the government.
Well, you said you've never been a political actor. Do you have any political ambitions?
Maybe someday. Mm-hmm. I think we need leaders. I think we need people to stand up and speak out. I see too many people who are more concerned with winning the next election than they are with doing what's right. And I'd like to be different.
All right. Well, we wish you luck with that. Thank you for being with us. Mike Gordon, former federal prosecutor who's been fired for his role in prosecuting the January 6th rioters. Thanks also to our Cracker Jack WMNF volunteers, Jessica Green and Barbara Fling. And always, thanks to you, our valiant WMNF listener supporters, for tuning into Midpoint. Don't forget, our new WMNF speaker series is kicking off August 21st, at the Commodore Club with Nadine Smith, founder of Equality Florida, who's going to be talking about what works in the resistance. We need that. It'll be good. I encourage you to get on the WMNF website, WMNF.org, and get yourself some tickets. They're $10 in advance. Now stay tuned for Talking Animals with Duncan, followed by the conversation with Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. We are 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa.